Welcome back to the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring national security, power, and intelligence in the 21st century. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Professor Joseph Nye, author of The Future of Power. Also joining us today from IBM is Frank Strickland. Professor Nye, for some, the containment strategy justified the Vietnam War. For George F. Kennan, the author of that strategy, it did not. You point out that more important than simple formulas or clever slogans is contextual intelligence. What is contextual intelligence, and how critical is it in the development and use of smart power strategies?
Contextual intelligence is the ability of a leader to understand the context of power, to realize that power is not the same in all contexts. And this is something which is important to foreign policy, but it's actually important to everyday life. Many a business leader who's very successful in the hierarchy of a corporation comes to government and learns that politics in a fishbowl is very different. And similarly, many a government leader who may come to a university to be an administrator and used to be able to give orders in a university, in a government, doesn't realize that the power structure of a university is very, very flat. There's not much you can do with these tenured professors. Maybe you can take away their parking space, but you can't really fire them. So understanding different contexts of power is crucial to developing successful strategies. In foreign policy, it means understanding which of the instruments of power you have, hard and soft, will be effective in which situations. And I'll take you back to that example I gave of Obama in Libya. One can agree or disagree about whether you should be involved in a humanitarian intervention in Libya. But if you're going to do it, then the thinking through what is that particular context, why is it important for me to have an Arab League resolution and a UN resolution, and waiting to use your hard power until you had that, and then using your hard power in judicious proportions, that's an example of contextual intelligence.
Power based on information resources is certainly not new, but cyber power is. The diffusion of power in the cyber domain, as you alluded to, has produced many, many new actors. What are the three faces of power in the cyber domain, and who are some of the actors involved, and what might be some of their key vulnerabilities that affects them?
Well, the fascinating thing about power in the cyber domain is there's an extraordinary blurring of what's governmental and non-governmental, and non-state actors can play a much greater role. So, for example, if you imagine that the United States woke up one day to find that the electrical grid was down, let's say in February, and all the pipes were freezing, and it was the result of a malicious worm like Stuxnet, which recently disrupted the Iranian nuclear centrifuge program, we wouldn't know who did it. It could be a government, a hostile government. It could be a individual hacker. It could be a criminal gang, or it could be cyber terrorism. Anybody clever enough to do that to us would route their attack in such a way that it would look like it was one of those other potential actors. And that then raises the question of if they do great damage to us, but we don't know who did it, where do we send the cruise missile? So it's a very interesting change in the cyber domain. You can talk, for example, in oceans or naval policy about supremacy. If you ask, you know, do the Americans, does the United States have naval supremacy? The answer is clearly yes. Now, there are non-state actors, pirates off the coast of Somalia, and they do have effects, but they're sort of noise in the system. They don't alter the overall conclusion that the United States has naval supremacy. It's very hard to know what supremacy means in cyber, because while we have enormous capabilities on the offensive side, we also are highly dependent on cyber and therefore more vulnerable. So what does superiority or supremacy mean? And if you can't be sure of who attacked you, whether it's a non-state actor or a government, and you can't figure out how to reply, then it makes it even more difficult to think through what's a successful strategy.
Professor Nye, counterinsurgency strategies emphasize the winning of hearts and minds of a civilian population. And RAND reports have concluded that the track record is mixed on this strategy and its application. In your mind, has this approach borne fruit of late? And more particularly, how can we expect to win hearts and minds of populations that possess a different historical and cultural root and tradition that is hardly liberal and definitely not Western?
Well, it's a very interesting question. I think counterinsurgency is an intelligent strategy. I mean, what Petraeus designed makes a lot of sense, which is instead of measuring your success by how many people you've killed, you measure it by how many minds you've won over. But it may turn out to be too expensive. In other words, it might be an interesting policy design in terms of combining hard and soft power. The theory is you clear, hold, and build. So clearing and holding is your hard power, military power, and building is roads and clinics and schools and so forth is your soft power. But if you're dealing with a culture in which the government is totally corrupt and in which you're not sure whether your aid programs are actually winning or losing people, then it's very hard to implement. Cultural reasons. It's also hard in terms of how long you can stay. In other words, it may turn out that if you need, let's say, something like for every 50 members of a population, you need one person who's a member of the security forces, but you need them there for a long time, it might turn out that we're just not willing to spend that amount of money and manpower for the decade or so that it might take. So in addition to the cultural barriers, there's a question of the cost and then the question of whether the benefits and cost are proportionate. So one can admire the design of Petraeus' strategy and still raise particular questions in places like Afghanistan or Iraq or other places as to whether it's worth it.
I'd like to transition to the role of networks and partnerships in 21st century world politics. How does participating in networks, formal or informal, present great opportunities to shape preferences and agendas?
Well, very often countries are influenced by the views of others. So say take the group of 20, which brings together top leaders. It doesn't have any secretariat. It doesn't have any bureaucracy. It can't make any decisions. But in the process of discussion and talking, you can have some influence on how others will behave. So that's an example where a new network organization, the G20, becomes something that sets the agenda. Bureaucrats in countries that are preparing for these meetings suddenly start turning to issues which are going to be on the agenda of the G20, and that affects the government as it prepares for this. Similarly, leaders may have some influence on each other as they discuss in these meetings how to approach certain items during the issues, during the crisis, the economic crisis of 2008 and 9. The fact that G20 leaders openly discussed the dangers of falling into protectionism as countries did in the 1930s maybe have helped somewhat to avoid at least the worst or most overt forms of protectionism. So network-type organizations, that is organizations which are focusing on agenda setting and persuasion rather than having a bureaucracy and a budget and implementation, can play a very important role. Now, it doesn't mean they're sufficient. You're really going to have to think about institutions in the 20th century of involving basically a variety of types of institutions. So the G20 may agree on something in the financial area at the level of leaders, but implementing it and doing the studies that are necessary to implement require working with the International Monetary Fund, which has a bureaucracy and a budget and a lot of very able economists. So it essentially we're going to have to think of what the Europeans sometimes call variable geometry of using different institutions and networks for different purposes.
What does the future hold for advancing the use of smart power? We will ask Professor Joseph Nye, author of The Future of Power, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.